you would be surprised at the gazillions of different unique things. I remember someone was sending out rubber chickens, and I was like, that seems dumb and silly. But depending on your audience, if you have a quirky pun note next to it that resonates, it's like you could kind of grab someone's attention through the most quirky things.
This is Revenue Makers, the podcast by Sixth Sense, investigating successful revenue strategies that pushed companies ahead.
Okay, Saima, I'm going to send you a gift. Do you want chocolates or purse?
All of the above.
Okay, well, you know what? We'll do with both. So anyway, that was the fun intro, but we have a great guest today. We have Chris Rudigrap, who is the CEO of Sendoso. And we talked about gifting and account-based marketing and a whole bunch of other things in between. But gifting as an ABM tool is pretty powerful. And Chris had some really great insights on it because he's started a company that does exactly that.
No, and it was something that filled a gap in his day-to-day as a seller. But as we think of all the things we're doing on the ABM side, using an intent signal to understand that an account is in market and then putting together a really rich gifting experience to break through all the noise and get in front of them and delight them and surprise them. I mean, we see it every day. We use gifting extensively here at Sixth Sense in our ABM motions. And so it was kind of cool to get his perspective based on the huge amounts of data that they're able to collect and understand around preferences and what works and how does this tie down to revenue. Overall, super fun.
If you listen in, there are some actionable things you can take with you right away and start to think about and start implementing. Even if you don't need, you know, necessarily a platform, you can start small with gifting. And there's some really great tactics and ideas that were discussed. So let's get into it.
Let's do it.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us today. We're excited to have you here.
Yeah, really excited to be on the pod.
Wanted to just jump in and CEO Sendoso, but really interesting path. Right. Because again, you know, you don't always see an account exec who went straight into a CEO role and had been there for a while. So I'd love to just start there and talk about like what's the kind of been the path that's gotten you to where you are and the things you've seen along the way.
Yeah, definitely an unusual path, a big jump there. But for me, I saw a problem in the market. So I was in sales for about a decade and I was sending out a gazillion emails like a lot of sales reps. And that was kind of my lifeblood of building pipeline and closing deals. And I started to see more and more email platforms coming out, making it easier and easier to send out sequential emails. This was back in like 2016. Yeah. And so I started writing handwritten notes and sending them out. I'd start, you know, going to steal swag from the marketing closet in the office and boxing it up and sending it out. Or I was on a call and heard a dog bark and I'd send some dog toy out to the prospect afterwards. And it all worked really, really well. It helped me build more rapport, but it was just super manual and time intensive. And I was like, I wish there was a platform that did this for me. And there wasn't. So I said, hey, maybe I can build this. And I think, you know, entrepreneurs are crazy and insane. I'm like, I think I can build a logistics and warehousing and software and integrations. You know, I didn't know what I didn't know at the time. And so I just dove right in.
I love that you thought you could do it all. Like, I just love that because there's so many people who listen who have great ideas, but it's always like the, oh, but I don't know anything about that, or I don't know where I could even start. So how did you even start?
I was looking around if I had any engineering friends that were like willing to work for free to build this project with me. Couldn't find any. So I said, hey, I've got money saved up from making commissions, closing deals. So I went to Upwork and I found an engineer and just started paying him. At the time, I was still working my daytime job as a sales. So I'd funneling a little bit of my commission checks into Upwork and had an engineering and then added another engineer and had a few more and the rest was history. I was just able to not let anything get in my way. So
I think all of us have had an idea. It's like, ooh, and then you'd like, I think that's the stumbling block. Like, how am I actually going to physically make this thing? So on that path, as you know, obviously you're building it, how much of your time were you able to spend on, okay, we're going to build this thing. Okay, let's start to message it, how it's going to take it to market. Because you're like in the weeds of like paying somebody through a website to code it.
Yeah.
But like, how did you make that? Okay, like obviously this is a marketing tool. We have to market the heck out of this thing. We're going to market to marketers and sellers. Like that's not easy.
Yeah. For me, it was, I had a lot of connections I knew and I did a lot of early, hey, what's your feedback on this? And I went like the feedback path because I think a lot of people are willing to share feedback. And so it wasn't salesy, but it was kind of salesy where I'm like, hey, I want to show you, get you feedback on this. And then they're like, oh, this is cool. And I'm like, okay, I'll count you in to sign up once this is ready. And I did that like 100 times. And I think coming from a sales background, I wasn't scared at all to just reach out and cold call everybody and anyone that I could ever think of. And I think that is probably a little bit different than maybe like a product or engineering co-founder who might be a little bit more reserved, being like, well, I don't know how to cold call. I don't know how to find a list. I don't know how to set up a cold email sequence. That was all second nature. So I was like, that's the easy part. And then it was just like talking to customers or prospects at the time that were in our funnel, and then just kind of talking about the messaging with them and how they thought about this, what the problem I was solving for them, which wasn't like a necessarily a net new thing. It was just a better mousetrap. I mean, people were gifting before I started this. People were sending direct mail before. It was just a very manual, time intensive, not integrated, not ROI connected effort. And so it was kind of obvious to say, hey, don't you want to use software for this instead of having your team do this? So
super cool. I mean, we've had enough conversations with folks on this podcast now who started in one part of go-to-market, then moved to another. And that tends to be the superpower, truly, because then you're able to jump in and fit whatever mold you need to fit. Just very cool to hear that from you as well, and the unique path you've had.
It also really helped, too, on the sales side when I was, quote unquote, selling to VCs to get them to invest. I'd use my, you know, salesmanship there. Or you kind of have to sell early employees to join the company, because you're like, do you want to work at a cool big company that has a brand name and you're going to get paid well? Or do you want to work for my company that no one knows about and you're going to get paid a little bit? So you're going to have to sell the vision, sell the dream. So I think being in sales really helped me in the early days for not just getting customers, but finding employees, getting investors.
How many times at bat, I know you don't want to talk about this, I'm sure there was some interesting along the ways during the funding and all of that. And obviously, there's about 800,000 books and blog posts and like, here's how you pitch and this is what you do and this is what you don't do. Anything there that was a unique from your perspective that maybe you took a different, I mean, obviously the seller's path helped, but something that was different for you, or you just go in there and figure it out and you managed to find investors?
Yeah, for me, it was a bit of one. I knew I needed to build up some more traction. And so I bootstrapped as long as I could with my own money so that I could show traction, because I wasn't some like third time exiting CEO that was like obvious to bet on. So I said, hey, I'm going to grind the extra 6 months to get the extra $500,000 in ARR so that when I go to talk to investors, they have proof. And so traction and proof was my strategy. And then, I don't know, building a slide deck, that was easy for me. I did that a million times in sales. And then putting a list together of VCs to go after, that was easy. And then getting told no like 20 times, I think that can be rough on an entrepreneur or founder who's like, this is my baby. I just spent a year building this. Everyone's going to love it. And then the VC's like, nope, or ghost you. And I was like, who cares? I am from sales. You get ghosted and said no to all the time. That didn't hurt my morale or hurt my ambition at all. It was just, okay, you're not the right one. I'll find the next one.
Yeah. So you said something really interesting. You said traction and proof. And I feel like that's probably what all of us are trying to do in all of our roles, right? Yes, gifting a personal touch in that sales journey, really making that personal connection is meaningful. But talk about some of the proof points now that you've built this company and in this role for so long.
Yeah, it's been amazing to see. I mean, we've been lucky enough, and especially with this recent acquisition of Alice that we completed about a month ago. So we've seen about 10 million gifts sent, over 100,000 senders sending. And so it gives us some really interesting data on what's working, what are the right gifts people are sending, connecting into their CRM, their marketing automation, their ABM tools, so that we can kind of complete the loop. And so all that's actually been super beneficial in us to build this kind of AI engine on top of all of this data set that we were lucky to have, which 5 years ago, I wouldn't have even thought that we would be using this data. I'm like, hey, we're just going to keep it all. We'll figure out what to do with it. And then over the last few years, it's been a godsend to be able to look at all of these data points.
Is your AI engine like recommending?
Yeah, exactly. So this is something that's a little bit newer for us. But for us, there's kind of this framework that we've always thought about, which is what's like the right gift to the right person with the right message at the right time with the right delivery channel. And for many years, we were preaching that. It was just a bit more of a manual process. So we were like, okay, salesperson, okay, marketer, you got to figure out most all those yourself. But now we have a functionality that will allow you to put in your email address and it will find something very personal to you. Or you can put in like a persona saying, hey, I want to for a head of marketing in, you know, New York, what would they like? And then it uses all of our data points to see what's going to work and what part of the funnel and how to drive conversion. We also use AI to write the messaging for you. So that's something that we've seen you know, millions and millions of messages being written for either handwritten notes or the e-gift message. And we can see which ones of those are driving conversion. And then we can use that to bring that back into how we help our customers. There's things we're working on, suggest who else in the buying committee you should gift to that maybe haven't received a gift yet, which is a really strong ABM tactic. And then one of the innovations we've been working on for a while is the right delivery channel. So is Chris in the office or not? What's his home address or his office address? So getting that right, you can always ask. So we have the address confirmation feature, but sometimes the surprise and delight component of gifting allows for that spontaneity and that response. So it would be sometimes awkward if I was like, hey, can I ask to email you? It's like, no, you just email somebody. So
data. So we're talking about all the data that you have that the customer is able to use, but coming from an AE world, I think like our sellers and any sellers are always looking for data to make their job better. Marketing is looking for data to better target even before that. So how have you, in building the business, having that AE perspective, there's a day that doesn't go by, and I'm sure Sonic can attest this as well, that we're not talking about more data that we want to get at, whether it's in our platform or more data that we want to get at from customers or prospects. How do you build that internal sort of mechanism or democratization of data, if I want to make a fancy word around it, to really kind of get your go-to-market teams aligned? Because it sounds like obviously data is so intrinsic to your business that I would imagine you've got a pretty significant effort to enable your sellers as well, or the whole growth team.
There's kind of two ways to look at that. One is we look at data from like the product perspective and how our product and R&D team is accessing data, building a data set that's really unique or that our customers can then use themselves. And we're our own customers. So we've actually seen some really interesting data use cases from some of the personalized data that we're seeing, using that into ads or into landing pages to drive conversions by way of putting in a gift in an image on an ad or whatnot. So there's some really interesting things we're doing with this gifting data set that we're using, our sellers are using. And then on the go-to-market side, like you said, just data in general has been a key focus for us. And one of our reasons why we tried to centralize this kind of growth ops team that, you know, we think is critical to the future of more skilled and more automated outbound, but also automated outbound expansion too. And I think the infrastructure for all that is good data. You got to have good CRM data. You got to have good intent data, good signal data. And then all that has to be speaking together. So you're not accidentally using data the wrong way, which can hurt way worse than not using data at all in your outbound. So we've definitely shifted a lot of our efforts from 5 years ago to having 50 plus SDRs to shrinking the team down, using more automations like a tool called Clay to really automate a lot of our outbound, but driving the same exact results with less people, which has been cool to see.
And it goes back to just really core marketing principles around getting in front of the right accounts at the right time, speaking to them in a meaningful way,
yes,
multi-threading and covering the entire buying team, right? Like so many facets of that. Can you talk a little bit about some of the intent signals that you're using or that no one else is using yet?
Yeah. I mean, we're using a lot of the obvious ones from you guys, obviously, as well. You know, when accounts are trending and surging and buying decisions. Again, my sales background leads me to be trying to be like a growth hacker and always getting creative. So we do use some other unique signals, especially as we orchestrate it through some of our outbound with Clay. The few that popped to mind, one is we've seen some really interesting signals from podcasts and webinars that are out in the wild. So the cool thing there is that like right now, as I talk, we're going deep on a subject. I might say things that you couldn't really just like find out there without it. And with some of these AI technologies that allow you to take audio, programmatically transcribe it, programmatically pull out the right pieces of information from that, and then programmatically use that through API into your outreach, you can, without humans, go and scour the web. There's a tool called Listen Notes that's like a podcast search engine that has an API. And then through other tools, ingest a bunch of webinars and pull out content. So I think there's some really interesting intent data locked in conversations that people have that a few years ago, you'd have to manually listen to that and manually pull out the things. And now with technology, it's so automated. So yeah, I think that's the one that we've been seeing a lot of success with too.
Guess we better watch what we say now in terms of who's going to start trying to sell.
Otherwise, you're going to get retargeted and someone's going to bring it up in an email.
I think I'm just going to put it out there. Chocolates, shoes, bags, you know, the things that I love.
Private jet at a low cost. Can we get that?
I feel like that reminds me when like you're talking to your phone when you think Facebook's listening or you're like, find ads for travel. And
all that just freaks me out. I mean, even my kids now, right? Because they're like, their entire life is just their So I don't know what it was. The other day, I think we were talking about a vacation, and like an hour later, myself, like I just got an ad on YouTube for like a hotel. Like, okay, they're watching. Everyone's watching. Just that's what you have to deal with.
Yeah, it's a more personalized world, though. I'd rather that than getting advertised for something that's completely wrong and not personal. And I love personalized ads. It's like my favorite.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think being marketers and sellers, you look at that, you respect good advertising, good marketing. You're like, wow, okay, like how do I do that? That's
exactly.
I want to get a little bit back to basics for a second too, because we've been kind of weaving in and out the concept of gifting and AI and all that. But when you think about gifting as a whole, right, and its place in account-based marketing, again, we talk about account-based marketing a lot here. For you, what are the fundamental tenets of that? You know, we, Sixth Sense, we are heavy into gifting. We use it strategically for a lot of different things. We see really fantastic results for it, both from just new acquisition, retention, upsell, cross-sell, everything. It really plays a role and it weaves through all of it. But what, from your perspective, is like if I'm new to the world, maybe account-based marketing, I've got that up and running. I'm thinking, okay, what are some of these other channels that I can do? How does gifting come into play, and how would you guide somebody who's just getting started or thinking about it?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think about it in a couple of ways. One is, I think one of the important parts of ABM is thinking that there's a larger buying committee that you really need to engage with. And so using gifting is a great way to engage with multiple stakeholders at different times. So I think it gives you an excuse to send a gift to someone that might not be part of the conversation, but you can inform them. We also have seen a lot of people send out like really nicely printed content too. You know, it's not necessarily a gift, but it's again, a way to use our platform to say, hey, here's this nice success story from a similar company. And also here's a grab lunch on me too. And that's printed out and shipped in a FedEx envelope. If you get a FedEx envelope to your door, you're going to be like, what's this? And with a nice handwritten note and some material that you leave on your desk can really be again, just another way to inform more of the buying committee. I think that also works when you're kind of swarming an account. You know, if you see an account surging with some intense signals, you need to figure out who are all the other people that might be engaged and you want to reach out to. And so gifting can work there. Also, you said it too. Like, I think some people think about ABM as like a top of funnel. Like, hey, I'm just going to use ABM to market to get this account. I really think about it as the entire customer journey. And it sounds like you do too, or it's post sales, where it's expansion. And so that's another area where you can, you know, use gifting to welcome a new customer, send them a customer welcome kit. Now they're got the warm and fuzzies, you know, their first day during onboarding. And then you can set up milestones. Hey, you graduated from onboarding, or hey, I'm going to introduce you to your new, you know, account manager. And then there's the account manager like, I want to buy you lunch. Here's a gift for lunch, or other milestones or incentives too. We're seeing some savvy customers saying like, once you add your 50th user, you get XYZ, the swag kit pack. And it's trying to drive adoption through ways of kind of dangling a carrot. So I think that's interesting. And then recently I've been seeing more gifting being used in ABM ads. You'll put some chocolates in an image with the ad itself to try to drive conversion, or on landing pages too, where you're building account level landing pages for target accounts, or you're doing some dynamic web personalization and you're using a gift to incentivize someone to engage with content too.
Yeah, and all such great ideas. And it truly is across that entire customer lifecycle. And for me, I think there's a real synergy between intent and gifting. Because at the end of the day, we are all trying to sell to very broad target account lists, tens of thousands accounts sometimes. And you really want to be able to maximize your budget, because let's be honest, budgets are tight. And to be able to leverage an intent signal to say, okay, yes, of this entire pool of accounts that I could and should be selling to, here's the 7%, 10% that's truly in market.
Yeah.
Let's provide them with a really rich bottom of funnel type experience, a surprise, a delight, something more personal to break through all of that noise. And let's do other tactics maybe further upstream where we're not quite ready. So I think using the data, the technology, some of that close feedback, that loop that you're mentioning of here's what works and when it works, it becomes really powerful.
Yeah, segmenting is great. I mean, like you said, everyone doesn't have infinite budgets, and gifting is one of those channels that costs more, which I think there's benefit there in that it reduces the potential for saturation, because not everyone can gift everyone, you know, a $500 iPad every time. So it does limit the saturation and noise in the channel of gifting, but then you can segment it more yourself, like you said. And if someone's has high intent and they're in a buying decision, you maybe send something better than maybe a broader stroke or someone that's still an early intent.
What surprised you over the years in terms of gifts that are resonating or helping move the needle? You have insight into so much data. It's curious.
The amount of creativity in gifting, it blows my mind. So, you know, I think some of the obvious ones were like the most popular thing we've sent is Yeti mugs. That doesn't surprise, although I think Stanley would be up the running there as of recently, but still Yeti resonates well. And socks are also very high on the list of popular things to send. But we have this really unique Amazon integration that allows you to either A, can suggest things based on someone's interests, and we'll accompany that with an Amazon product. And Amazon will also send it to our warehouse. We can unbox it, rebox it, put a handwritten note and ship it out. So it looks like it's coming very personal, not just from Amazon. And so you would be surprised at the gazillions of different unique things. I remember someone was sending out rubber chickens, and I was like, that seems dumb and silly, but depending on your audience, people want to enjoy their day. They want to like have fun. And if you're selling into a persona that's, you know, in sales or marketing or a bit more friendly and upbeat, I'm not sure a rubber chicken to like a CISO might work, but depending on your audience, if you have a quirky pun note next to it that resonates, it's like you could kind of grab someone's attention through the most quirky things.
I think chickens for everyone is going to be what, just start sending rubber chickens. We actually have one at home. One thing I want to dig in a little bit, because it's fascinating to me, and I think it probably will lead into the conversation like what the future looks like from gifting. But when you talked about bridging that gap between the physical gift and the digital world, whether it's through ads or it's through landing pages and lot dialing and personalization and so forth, with this sort of interest graph that you've essentially built, right? Do you see a play in the future, whether it's your product or something in a whole, where all of those interests start to sort of be used in other ways, not just in a gifting way, but to start to make other recommendations? I'm curious, like, if that's A, something that you're thinking about, and B, like, other kind of like forward-looking future possibilities for gifting and so forth.
1,000%. Our customers are pulling us in that direction too and asking us, hey, how do we've got this really rich data set. Our customers are our prospects. A lot of times too are telling what they want because we have the ability to let the recipient pick gifts too. So we can use that even further to hone in on what their interests are. And then we've built this really interesting AI tech behind the scenes too that scours social media, LinkedIn posts, other things that we can see if people are posting golf pictures, et cetera. So all of that I think will be used to really build out these better personalized landing pages, personalized ads, or using the best converting gift in an ad that helps it convert better than just a text. For a lot of companies, it's worth adding the $30 gift if you get the click and you get the conversion, especially if your ACV's 50 grand, 100 grand, even smaller, you can still afford the extra $50 gift on the ad click. So I think the interest graph will be used. And I think at the end of the day, marketers' dream is this really personalized experience, whether you're personalizing it to the persona, whether you're personalizing it to the account, and then the holy grail, personalizing it to the individual too.
Yeah, there's so many possibilities there. Amazing.
At the end of the day, you know, everyone is going after so many of those same people and accounts. People are bombarded with messages. And so really cutting through that is an experience that resonates very much, I'm sure. Chris, we ask every guest on the podcast this question. What's the most ridiculous thing that you've been asked to do in your role in, you know, your career? Ridiculous good or ridiculous bad?
One of the most ridiculous things that had happened to me was when it was probably year two of Sendoso. We had to move warehouses, and the day before we were moving it, one of our warehouse managers left. And so I had to come in and move our warehouse. At the time, our warehouse was in Vegas. So I was like, I guess I can do that. I kind of set up our logistics from like a high level, from like more of the corporate office. I'd come and visit from times, but I was not on the floor working all the intricacies of pick packing and scanning and using warehouse management software. So I remember a Friday, I flew into Vegas, and then I went to the ATM and tried to pull out as much money as I could because I needed to pay all these Craigslist workers to come in and help us sort things. And then spent like 3 days not sleeping, moving warehouse, and did it, but it was quite the story.
That definitely qualifies for sure.
It goes back to being a, you know, when you're a founder or an executive, sometimes you just got to do whatever you got to do to get the job done.
We usually would stop there, but actually, because I'm a little bit of a supply chain dork, which is kind of weird, but I'm just curious now, like, do you have like a vast network now, like in terms of like this warehouse? Or you talk about one warehouse, but are you like, how does all that?
No, we have warehouses, multiple in Europe and Australia, multiple in the US. Our largest one's about 200,000 square feet in Arizona. That does a lot of our US domestic logistics. And then we have this really insane on-demand marketplace so that if you want to send like macaroons to somebody in Paris, it'll come from like a local bakery there. And so we've set up tens of thousands of these local drop shippers around the world. And most of them are a small business Shopify store that's able to ship something from Mexico or Korea, wherever you may need to be. So we can provide personalized or perishable items while also providing this warehousing and kitting. So there's a lot of moving parts. And then we have all of our manufacturers and suppliers that are sourcing swag or gifts or materials that we then kit together at one of our warehouses. So there's another supply chain side. And just because you're geeking on this, Adam, we've built software for warehouse management. There's software for our inventory management. And then there's order management software. So no one sees that. But at the end of the day, it's kind of like the magic of Amazon, where you just click a button and then it's there. Similar with us, it's like you click a button and it's there, but then it also like tracks in your CRM and it triggers off your sales engagement tool. So there's a lot of intricacies that match all of the SaaS front end to all the stuff moving behind the scenes.
Well, I think that's cool personally. So,
and again, we should have ended the podcast, but now I have another question from that. You talked about, you know, obviously doing this around the world. I think it's so cool that you are helping local businesses thrive. Do you find significant differences across the world into gifting preferences and what people are interested in?
Oh, yeah. As well as some of the nomenclature. The surprising one for me was like 5 years ago, we were talking to a customer who was rolling out some European gifting for them. And they was like, I want to send a hamper. And in the US, I'm like, a clothes hamper? That's kind of weird. What's the deal? And no, hamper is like a gift box term. So even the nomenclature is unique. So in our marketplace, if you're searching for Europe, you'll see hampers. So anyway, there's all those kind of nomenclatures. There's certain regions like the US, gift cards are really popular, but in a lot of other countries don't have as much of a gift card network, or country by country, because US is just all these states that work together with the same currency and all the same businesses across state borders, but other countries know. So gift cards are really unique to certain regions. And then, yeah, the gifting suggestions, which is nice because for us, we can provide you suggestions if you are launching in a EMEA program and you want to send to somebody in the DACH region versus somebody in, you know, Greece or something. You don't have to do all the heavy lifting yourself.
Well, as much as that was a little bit of a diversion into supply chain and international, I thought that was some interesting info there. So, Chris, thanks so much for joining us. Really enjoyed it. Really interesting stuff. And I think obviously we're going to be watching closely with Sendoso in the future and seeing what all sorts of data-backed products and services you can bring to market. So thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Revenue Makers.
Do you have a revenue project you were asked to execute that had wild success? Share your story with us at sixthsense.com/revenue, and we might just ask you to come on the show. And if you don't want to miss the next episode, be sure to follow along on your favorite podcast app.